session number 34090, reel 8.
Traditionally, the Observer Corps was a male-dominated organisation. Starting in 1925 in Maidstone. Maidstone is number one group. Horsham is number two. Oxford's number three. So it spread from the southeast, and it was staffed by men only. And the men spotted aircraft, they reported aircraft, they had crude ops rooms where they plotted aircraft on charts and maps, and that continued right up to World War II. If you look at photographs, either on the posts or in the ops rooms, all the staff is of relatively middle-aged to elderly men, very often bald, mustachioed, but all male province. And the plotters and the tellers are all male, because they were in the start of World War II. But, of course, all the younger men and a lot of the middle-aged men were being called up for the forces. The Observer Corps was, like a lot of organisations, was running short of the pool of recruits. And so in April 1941, it was decided to enrol ladies into the Corps. And this was quite a forward-thinking step. It was somewhat controversial. There were posts, there were controls, or ops rooms as they called them then. Control is normally a phrase used for the nuclear ops room. So the aircraft ops room was called an ops room. But many of the units that had got used to men only actually didn't want women. And there were protests, and, oh, we don't want any silly old women on our post and things like that. But women came in, first of all, primarily in the ops room. I don't know why, but there is a tendency for ladies to be probably better than men at plotting. And so it was quite common, not just in RAF, not just in Royal Observer Corps ops rooms, but in RAF and Navy and Army ops rooms to have lady plotters. And that's where predominantly the ladies were employed. In all other ways, they were equal to the men. They were paid the same, although the pay was very small. They were issued with a uniform, and they sat side by side with their male counterparts. A curiosity was that you still had the older male observers, and most of the ladies that joined the Corps in the war were young. And you'd got this curious mixture of young girls and older men. The older men must have thought they were in paradise, you know, because they got all these very, very nice lady plotters around them. But they did prove their worth, there's no doubt about it. And since then, of course, women have been admitted into the Corps right up to stand down in 1991. Many of the ladies went on to become NCOs. Many of the ladies went on to become officers. We never did have a female commandant. We never or very seldom did we have any female full-time officers. There were one or two, but not all that many. But there were quite a few female group commandants. These were spare time people who ran a group. We never did have a lady group commandant for Cornwall and Devon, ever. But Verrien Post, for example, a lady, a very prominent lady called Kathleen Connor, she joined Verrien Post in World War II. She was a valued member of the post, and she went on to become the chief observer of Verrien. And indeed, she was running Verrien Post in a very efficient way. And she was so capable. She was actually awarded the BEM in the early the late 1940s, and she is the first Royal Observer Corps lady BEM holder. That's Kathleen Connor, who served on Verrien Post.
So BEM, is that British Empire Medal?
British Empire. Right? It's discontinued now. There's only the MBE, but yes, she was awarded the BEM. So, because the Observer Corps, like the military, is eligible for any award. Obviously, medals like the MBE and the BM are very rare, but we are eligible for the Lord Lieutenant's certificate, Strike Command, Commandant ROC certificate. There are certain levels, and many of these were awarded. At group level, we were eligible for the Lord Lieutenant of Cornwall's certificate, and roughly about four people per year were awarded the Lord Lieutenant certificate, for example. but I say, going back to ladies, I suppose ladies constituted about, at the maximum, about 25 to 30% of the manning of the Corps. 10,000 people in the Corps, 2 to 3,000 might be ladies. The ladies in World War II were generally young. Many of the young wartime lady members never did rejoin in 1947 because the Corps stood down on the 12th of May 1945 and then reformed on the 1st of January 1947. And many of those female Observer Corps members didn't rejoin because they were young. They'd got by then husbands, families, because they were the days when by the time you were 21 you were raising a family. So they didn't rejoin, and gradually from 1947 onwards, when the Corps was spare time almost totally, ladies gradually were recruited, but they tended to be a very mixed bag, like the men, varying in ages from relatively young girls of 18 or 19 to older ladies well into the 50s or indeed early 60s. Observers had to retire at 60 on, in the control in on the posts, and in the consoles it was 60 and on the posts it was 65. On the posts, it's fair to say, it remained a predominantly male domain for many, many, many years. And it was, I won't say rare to get a female post member, but they were probably constituted only about 5 or 10% of the post personnel. What's funny is that some posts refuse to have female observers on their post. In this day and age, it would be described as discrimination. But in those days, if you didn't want a female, they didn't push the matter and you were allowed to get away with it. Some posts actually found that they enjoyed female companions. And one lady would introduce another. And there's more than one post that had probably 50% ladies. So it did vary quite a lot. And as I say, all I can say is that they normally perform their role very well, but particularly in the controls. In the posts, because the posts were much more Spartan and much more sort of rugged in a sense, there were less females on posts. And whether they managed to carry out their duties as well as the men on the post, I'm not willing to say. But I think at times there are duties that they were limited on in a post, that is. But anyway, that's the sort of story of the ladies in the Corps. Just branching into the social side, right from square one, the Corps was a very sociable body, and socialising was encouraged, so that parallel with the operational work and the training, there would be quite an intense social side. And this was done deliberately because the intention was to create a team effort and a happy team, and socialising is an important part of that. So every unit at every level, whether it was at group or post or control or ops room, there will be dinners and dances and social meetings. People might meet in somebody's home, film shows, and so on. And of course, from a point of socialising, it was always advantageous to have certainly a sprinkling of ladies rather than none at all. So the ladies came into their own, really, from a social point of view, and made the, you know, it's rather, it would be rather embarrassing to have a dance if 99% of the people were male. But yeah, we used to socialise very well, and there was a tremendous esprit de corps in the Royal Observer Corps. In fact, we've been told that it was probably one of the best esprit de corps of any organisation in the UK, military organisation in the UK. Certainly in the nuclear role, when viewed by members of the services, for example, they just couldn't get over the enthusiasm that the Corps showed. And at times, military personnel would be told, well, of course, these people don't get paid. And they just couldn't believe it at all. The amount of expertise and enthusiasm and dedication that Observer Corps members showed was remarkable. And I think it was a very, it is a very big feature of the Corps, this sort of, you know, sense of comradeship. And it's still predominant now in the Royal Observer Corps Association, that we will travel hundreds of miles, you know, to go to a weekend function or a dinner to meet our former colleagues. It's still very strong now, that sense of comradeship and friendship. It's a bit like if you speak to a World War II person, he'll probably say now, in the year 2010, that the lasting friendships and the most vivid friendships are those they formed in World War II. And that's quite common. And it's the same with the Corps. You know, you've got friendships that you formed in the Corps that are stronger than any other. And there are also friendships that you can not see a person for 2 or 3 years, then see them and you start off immediately from where you left off. So it was a unique organisation in that respect. It was helped in part by the fact that the Observer Corps not only had weekly training meetings at local level, but they had group meetings. And this was this was available to anyone in a group like Devon and Cornwall. And they would have a meeting, a weekend meeting, either for NCOs or for officers, and a proportion of people would get together and have a dinner and training. It was always a favourite pastime to have a training meeting or have a training weekend where you would be taught or told about different things, new things coming in. And you would end up with a dinner in the evening. It was quite pleasant, and I'm sure lots of organisations do that. Every year, we had an annual training camp, and for a week, we would go on to an RAF station, and probably up to 500 observers would go on an RAF station in uniform, and we would have a training camp, 5 days of intense training, and 5 nights of intense socialising. They were much looked forward to, not only for the fact that you had a collection of 500, in effect, non-military people. For 1 week, they would be acting military style on an RAF station. And it tended to be an RAF a different RAF station every year. And you know, I've been on so many RAF stations in the UK, it's unbelievable. Places like Scampton and Waddington and West Raynham, Horsham St Faith, to name but a few, but Westmorling, Little Rissington, it just goes on and on. We used to parade every morning, and it was somewhat bizarre because the Observer Corps, being a semi-civilian organisation, didn't carry out any training in marching. But if you went to camp, you were expected to march, because that was the most convenient way to get people from A to B. And it was quite unusual to see all sorts of different shapes and sizes. All sorts of people who'd never marched before, actually trying to march. And it did get better towards the end of the week. But we had guards of honour, we had VIPs, and it all went very well. So it was a training camp side. just a word about awards, because we did touch on this before. The Observer Corps was eligible for national and local awards. The highest was probably the OBE that anyone ever got, although they were, you can count those on two fingers almost. The MBE was slightly more prolific. Probably one person every 2 years might get an MBE. This is the whole of the country. And same with the BEM, although the BEM was discontinued in the latter stages of the Corps. Far more prolific were the Commandant's Commandant ROC's Certificate of Merit, the AOC Strike Command, and probably the most prolific of all was the Lord Lieutenant's Certificate. In our case, it was Lord Lieutenant of Cornwall, and probably about four of these would be awarded every year. So many more people who were recommended got these certificates. As well as that, we had an annual test, which was called a master test. This was a proficiency test, so that all your training would be tested once a year. And in the old days, you actually had to recognise aircraft. In the nuclear days, you had to sit a written examination, which generally took about 3 hours. And if you got more than 90%, you got a master badge. If you got more than 80%, you got a first-class pass. And if you got below that, you got what they call an intermediate. And if you did really bad, you got a primary exemption. But if you got a master pass, you were eligible to wear the coveted Spitfire badge. And this was a plan view of a Spitfire, and it was sewn onto the sleeve. And it was the mark of a master observer. If you got five of these, that's 5 years of getting over 90%, you got a red Spitfire. And if you got 10, you got a red Spitfire and a red star. And if you got 15, you got a red Spitfire and three red stars. If you got more than that, you got a gold Spitfire. And these were really rare. Really rare, but it was the mark of a real master observer. I mean, can you imagine sustained effort every year, 25 times, to get a gold Spitfire? And we had several in Cornwall who did this. So, fortunately, when you became an officer, you didn't have to sit a proficiency test. So I, as an officer of quite a few years, actually didn't take all that many master examinations. They assumed the officer knew it all, but I'm not quite sure about that. But that was the sort of administrative setup and training. In terms of pay, the Observer Corps, we always said you don't get paid in the Observer Corps, you just get an allowance, and you did. The observers got paid a meeting allowance. And obviously, over the years, the allowance went up from very little to slightly more. In fact, even when the Corps closed in 1991, the meeting allowance was something like £3, and that included an element of mileage. So you're not in it for the money. An officer actually didn't get any meeting allowance at all, and yet he was probably making the most meetings of anyone. I got paid an annual grant, which was £400. On top of that, I could claim mileage for any journey that was not at my normal place of work, which was Truro, of course. So for £400, I attended weekly meetings every week. I attended any training meeting, exercises, and I didn't get anything apart from what was included in the £400. If I had an NCO's course at Newquay or Plymouth or further afield, then I could claim mileage. But as I say, you certainly weren't in it for the money. But that was the sort of reward you got. Overall, I think it was the comradeship and the friendships that and made you stay in the Corps. Many people did stay in the Corps. We've got the other medal that you could get is the Long Service Medal. And this was given to you after 12 years of service. After 24 years of service, you got a clasp. And after another 12 years, you got another clasp. And after, if you were in it 48, you got third class. And these were much sought after, the Long Service Medal and clasps. And, but it was recognition that you'd put in effort over a long time.
Have you received an award, or did you receive any medals or commendations?
Yeah. Well, that's going to be embarrassing now, isn't it? I actually, because I was in it 42 years, I actually received my Long Service Medal and two clasps, which is on the rare side. I got the Lord Lieutenant's certificate in the 1980s, and for my sins of many years of undetected crime, I was awarded the MBE in 1994, which was much appreciated. And so that was my own personal award history. Very lucky. I managed to get it just before the NRCs closed down in 1995. Rather unfortunately, in the Corps, there are so many examples of this. If you had a person who'd done many, many years of sustained effort, the year before they retired, and when you think that most people retire at 60 or 65, but say 60, the year before they retire, they would have got an award. And there are so many people who got either a Lord Lieutenant's or a Commandant's Award or an MBE or a BEM in the last year of their reign. In fact, some people were awarded it when they'd actually retired. I always thought that was a bit unfortunate. There was a pecking order, and we were well aware that there was almost an allocation. You never, ever got more than one or two MBEs a year. This is the whole of the country. You know, when there's 10,000 people in a pecking order, you know, it's a small surprise that there were few and far between. On my team at Truro, I was very fortunate. It's fair to say that the Truro team, there's no doubt about it, gained the most awards of any team in the UK. I actually had on my team at least four national award holders, i.e. MBE or BEM. I had quite a few people with Commandant's Certificate or AOC Strike Certificate, and a proliferation of people who got the Lord Lieutenant. So I had a very talented award-winning team, by far the most of anywhere in the country, there's no doubt about that. So we were lucky, That's about it, isn't it?
Well, that's great, that's fantastic.
I'll try to go through it all.
I'm just going to have a quick whiz through to see if I can find anything else, but I think we've covered pretty much everything in one way or another over the last two sessions.
Yeah.
No, it's really amazing. Thank you ever so much.
I can't think of anything. Your mind flirts from one thing to another.
Yeah.
I mean, another thing about the Observer Corps, a bit like the services, we were always very good at laughing at ourselves. And I suppose TV examples are Dad's Army and Hello, Hello. Mm. And but the Observer Corps was exceedingly good at laughing at itself. And over the life of the Corps, there are literally thousands of cartoons of jokes, stories and things like that. One man who I will mention is called Sessions. And he started drawing cartoons way back in the early 40s, 1941, and he died around about the 1957 mark. But he produced a proliferation of cartoons of observers and of Observer Corps life. And his cartoons, more than any, actually depicted what are called real people, but in cartoon form. You could actually look at one of his cartoons and say, yeah, I've seen that guy. And, you know, whether he's got a piece of straw sticking out of his berry or looking absolutely gormless at somebody or a pompous officer, because Sessions was one of the first people who, in cartoon form, poked fun at officers. He would draw officers as pompous, silly asses, if that's the right word. And we've all seen them. We've all seen them. He would draw the lady observers, bearing in mind that he died in 1957. He would draw lady observers with pouting lips and big bosoms. And we've all seen that type. You know, so the Observer Corps cartoon history is quite a valued one. Going on to that sort of thing, miscellaneous stuff now, the Observer Corps was never very musical. There have only been two pieces of music ever written about the Corps. One is a march, which was commissioned for the Observer Corps, and it's called Skywatch. And Skywatch has been recorded. You can actually get it on tape or disc. And that is a typical RAF-style march, but not as good as the Dambusters or the RAF march itself. But that was the Observer Corps march called Flypast. The other one is a song called Sentinels of Britain, and it was written way back in 1942. And it is a typical sing-songy type piece of music, typical of World War II, typical of people like Vera Lynn or what have you. But it's the only piece of music which has words to it. So if you want to, you can actually sing words about the Observer Corps to this particular piece of music, which is very good, very good. And of course, in the written word, there are a considerable number of books written about the Observer Corps. Having said that, there aren't all that many which are totally dedicated to the Corps. By far, the best two. The first one was written in 1946, and it's called Forewarned is Forearmed, which is our motto, by a man called Winslow. He was a former commandant. And that charted the history of the Corps up to 1946. A man called Eric Wood then wrote another definitive history called Attack Warning Red, which actually deals with the history of the Corps from 1925 to 1972. Although the title suggests the nuclear role, it actually covers the whole history of the Corps. Attack Warning Red is probably the Bible of the Corps. Rather unfortunately, It stops in 1972 when it was published. And in 1992, they did reissue Attack Warning Red with an addendum, a very short addendum, charting the Corps' history from 1972 to 1991. And almost unbelievably, no one has picked up the challenge and written a total history of the Corps. There are quite a number of individual small books on group histories, or post histories for that matter. You know, a former post observer might decide to write down the story of a particular post and his memories of it. One or two people have done the history of a whole group. Unfortunately, Devon and Cornwall have no group history, well, apart from what I've done, and I've done a potted history of it, as far as I know. Again, no one's published any book in Devon and Cornwall about a post history. I've done post histories, but they're just for me sort of thing, and I've done them on the computer, and that's it. But I've got so much information now that people are asking me all the time, when are you going to write that book? And I haven't got time. I'm spending all the time being interviewed. No, that's unfair. Right, I think that's
okay. Yeah, that's lovely. Yeah.